Hey, everyone. Real unique show in store for you today. Jeff Van Gundy and Tom Crean on the differences, the similarities of coaching in the NBA and big-time college basketball, their influences, the changing state of the coaching profession, how players have evolved. A real interesting conversation with two of the real thoughtful minds in any sport, Jeff Van Gundy and Tom Crean. Here we go. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Vertical Podcast with Woj. My guests today both have been on the show, but never together. Jeff Van Gundy and Tom Crean. Guys, thanks for jumping in.
No problem. Great to be with both of you.
Hey, Jeff, there's something I think you can help Tom with here. I was on the phone with Tom yesterday, and all of a sudden I heard him talking to somebody else saying, am I in the right line? Is this the right place? Am I in the right line? And it hit me pretty quickly. Now coaches are used to doing drop-off duty in the morning, then going to the office. Usually when you have more free time, you're doing the pickup. So what's the key, Jeff, on the pickup in the school line versus drop-off in the morning?
Well, listen, after being fired, you have to take your competition to where you can get it. And mine was to cut down my travel time by like 10 seconds. But I always, my strategy is to go early and park early. Like, I'd rather be there 15 minutes early and never wait versus get there on time and wait 15 minutes. That's just a personal pickup philosophy that I've developed over the years.
Oh, hey, you know, I was trying to remember when you two actually, I know when I got to know both of you guys, but when did you guys, you've been friends for a long time in the coaching profession, and I know Tom spent some time around the Knicks when you were there, Jeff. When did you guys get to know each other?
You know, I don't even remember the first time, but I remember it was back in my Knick days, though, right, Tom?
It was, but the first time we ever spoke, and the first time I started trying to contact you and you returned it, you may not even remember this, I was coaching at Alma College, and I was still in college at Central Michigan, and you were actually, had just left Rutgers, I believe. Would that be right?
Yeah, I left Rutgers to go to the Knicks as an assistant.
Yeah, that's when it was. And we actually talked at that point, and then I became even more familiar with you when I went to Western Kentucky, because that's when I was still trying to really break into it. I was coaching in Division III while I was going to Central Michigan, but I was trying to learn and meet people. And you returned a call one time, and I'll never forget it. I was in the Alma office, and you called the phone. It was back when we were on regular phones, you know, which seems like just decades ago. It probably was decades ago with the regular phones. But you were great, right? And then when I got with Ralph Willard at Western Kentucky and start to study guys in that family even more and get to know you, your name would come up, your brother's name would come up, you know, all those types of things. And then we definitely met at one point then. And then when I was at Michigan State, actually at one point, I think is when we actually met face-to-face for the first time when I was a graduate assistant for Judd Heathcote at Michigan State. So it goes way, way back. Jeff has always been more than good to me, long before we ever became friends, and the friendship has been fantastic.
Yeah, and one of the things that I wanted to talk about with both you guys were coaching in the NBA versus the college life and where each side can learn from each other, where things are just vastly different. And I know this, Tom, you, as a young head coach, you talked about being in Jeff's office with the mm-hmm. Knicks, and something stayed with you on the wall there that you thought about through all your years as a head coach, which is universal to coaching, which is what?
Well, the one day that I went into New York, I had not coached a game yet at Marquette. I had the job and went in and spent the day. Tom Thibodeau was there. Brendan Malone was there. Matt Harding was there. Jeff was there. It was a summer day. And I learned so much that day. I learned a lot about so many things that we then started to formulate with statistics, with film review, with scouting. And because I'd already had a relationship with Jeff Knicks. And so I knew, you know, more and more about the Knicks. The thing that I will never forget were the headline framed covers from, I believe, the New York Post that absolutely just pillaging, okay, Jeff. You know, the toughest headlines you could possibly have. I think he chose three or four of them to put up above his desk you know, and to me, that always was a great visual to me of a couple things. Number one, you can never take those things too serious. Number two, it can add fuel and motivation when you're feeling down or when you're feeling real good about yourself. And number three, at the end of the day, what matters most is that you don't let something get you down that comes from a place that really doesn't understand what you're doing. And headline writers very rarely understand what a coach or anybody else is doing. So I took a lot from that.
Jeff, when you made that jump from Rutgers to the NBA, and I remember we've talked about this in the past, to go from that college, you had been at Providence with Rick Pitino as a grad assistant, and then at Rutgers, you went from, you know, coaching and recruiting to, I think your first assignment was, you're going to coach the Summer League. When you think back to sort of making that move, how dramatic was that for you from going those college kids to showing up and now I'm going to be the head coach of a summer league team?
Well, actually, Adrian, I was like the Stu Jackson had just taken over. So he was still sort of coaching it, mm-hmm. but I was with Paul Silas and Ernie Grunfeld. And I still remember after the first practice, I'm like sitting there in awe, like Eddie Lee Wilkins has to be one of the top players in the NBA, right? And that's what my thought was. He was phenomenal in practice. Like, you couldn't guard him. Like, I thought all these guys were so great. So I still remember, you know, it's my first NBA practice, and Stu had been there for 2 years with Rick, now as a head coach. Obviously, Ernie and Paul had lived the NBA. And so Paul Silas always looked out for me, and I remember I just met him that day, basically, and I said, man, these guys are good. He goes, these guys suck. And he goes, none of these guys can play. And I'm like, what? So then I go to, you know, this was pre, like, so my first NBA, like, training camp practice with all the guys, Mark Jackson, Patrick Ewing, Johnny Newman, Gerald Wilkins, et cetera, right? That's not, you didn't see him in September. You saw him the first day of training camp. I mean, it's totally different, right? So I still remember, like, walking off the floor and saying, I don't know what sport I've been involved with these last few years in college, but it's not this sport. Patrick Ewing was getting beaten on and scored every time, like on the most incredible shots. Mark Jackson's vision, like, was astounding. I mean, the level, the jump in skill level and athleticism between, you know, like an Atlantic 10 school like Rutgers was at that time, and the NBA was just, you know, it was hard to actually believe.
Tom, when you, well, you've had a lot of NBA players on their way up, but you've always liked to go spend time with, you've gone to a lot of NBA games when teams would come through Indianapolis, or you'd get on the road and go see Dwayne Wade play in an NBA Finals game. As a college coach, you're trying to project your guys and who really can play there. To sit courtside at an NBA game or in a practice, is it as dramatic as that versus what, you know, what you see day in and day out at the college level, where you might have one guy or two guys who are going to be rotation players in the NBA someday?
Oh, absolutely. Especially the closer you sit to the action or the closer you sit to the practice, and you see how little space is really there for the players to operate in. You know, obviously the court is the same. The NBA line is a little bit deeper. But the bottom line is there's so much less space because of the size, because of the first steps, because of the quickness, the length, and your ability that you have to get to separate, not only to create space, but then also to be able to separate away and then to navigate such tight spaces. And that's why the level of the NBA athlete combined with the level of the NBA talent, when you get an NBA skill level, well, now you've got a serious, serious player. And the more you have, every team has got the length, every team has got the size, but it's the guys that can separate, play inside of those tight spaces, stay committed to their spacing. All those types of things really show you the separation. And for me, I could never look at an NBA game or a practice and say that I didn't take something from that that I could bring back to my coaching or to my team. And it's the same with the film. Now, obviously, there's sometimes that teams don't play maybe quite as hard or guys don't go quite as hard in the drills, and you can learn from that too. But when I saw some of the best practices, I never saw Jeff Van Gundy walk through or a Pat Riley walkthrough or a Stan Van Gundy walkthrough or an Eric Spoelstra walkthrough or a Doc Rivers walkthrough, when I didn't walk out of there saying, this is an incredibly high level. I think there's so much to be learned from that. And I think players would be so much better off. I remember the first time I saw Michael Jordan in a walkthrough one time with Doug Collins, and Doug ran great practices. I didn't see a lot of them, but I saw some, especially when I was at Michigan State and he was in Detroit. I saw Michael Jordan at a walkthrough before a Bucks game near the end of his career. And it was a Friday morning. The Bradley Center was cold. The ice had been down the night before. They'd had a hockey game. So literally you could see guys' breath, okay, when they're starting their walkthrough at 10 in the morning. And I'll never forget, there's Michael Jordan. He's got the Jordan sweats. He's got a long-sleeve shirt on. He's got his practice jersey on. And you can see the sweat glistening off his head. And every shot had a purpose, every shot. And I think he might have – we started counting. I was with my old high school coach. I think he went, and this time we watched, he was probably like 53 for 56, somewhere in that area. And every time that he missed a shot, you know, he let out a curse word or yelled. There was such precision to what he was doing. Then to watch him in the walkthrough and the practice, and this is at a time when they had Alexander, Rip Hamilton, Kwame Brown, people like that. The seriousness that he practiced with, the seriousness that he went through the walkthrough with. I said to my old coach, I said, every player would be instantly 25-30% better just by watching what we just saw in the last hour. Because I know I got a lot better. And that's what I think, that if more people spent time watching how these guys work on their craft, the ones that are very serious about it, and all the coaches are serious about it, right? But the more that they spend time seeing how good you have got to be at separating, guarding, you know, all the details of the game, every player in college or high school would be so much better.
You know, Jeff, when you think of the guys who, you know, there's a lot of guys who've spent time between college and the NBA. They've been head coaches in both, or they've been high-level assistants in the NBA, gone back to college. You know, I've always sensed that if given the perfect world, most guys who've been in both would choose the NBA. And I thought Billy Donovan, in talking to him last year, kind of crystallized it in one respect, was that there's so much time, and Tom understands this from having been in it and recruiting at a high level. Like Billy said, how much time that I had to spend on guys I was never going to coach, like all the time in recruiting on guys I'm not going to get, that the older you got, it was harder to sort of come to terms with that. And that at least in the NBA, you know, while you don't have as much control of your roster as you do in college, if you want to get better, you can go out, get the players you want. In an ideal world, in the NBA, you're a little more landlocked sometimes on talent. But do you think the recruiting is as much of anything why guys just prefer the pro lifestyle and just, you know, not having to worry about graduation rates and academics and all these things colleges pretend to care about, but in the end just care about truly, like, you know, did you win or not?
Well, I think the first thing that, you know, at least I noticed when I went from college coaching to the NBA, is you were never on the phone. You live on the phone in college. You're never on the phone in the NBA. It's all basketball. I worked for John McLeod at the Knicks, and then he went to Notre Dame. And I remember asking him, how do you like it? And he says, oh, I love Notre Dame. It's just not very much basketball. So you are involved in basketball all the time versus the ancillary type of things that you have to do in college. I think the hypocrisy is big too. Like you just mentioned, Adrian, like if they want to get you in college, they start rummaging up graduation rates that would be absolutely acceptable if you were in the Final Four. So the other thing I think too, you're held accountable in college for your players' behavior, where in the NBA you're not held accountable at all. If a college student somehow commits a crime, that somehow, I don't know why, reflects on the coach and the program. But if an NBA player commits the same crime, it's only a reflection on him. It's not a reflection on your ability to coach. So I think there are a lot of differences. I think in the NBA, you know that the years are short. You're going to be judged strictly on winning and losing based upon how your owner feels you should be winning and losing. It used to be you got more rope in college. I would say that's not true anymore. And so I think that's why people, if given the choice now, would certainly take the NBA.
Well, I can attest to this with the academic part. We walked in here. We walked into like 19 Fs on the second day I was on the job. We had 3.5 weeks left of school. We got it down to 11. We lost all these scholarships, 3 scholarships, because of the APR. Well, we got it up, in fact, to the point where we had 1,000 on the APR, which obviously you can't be any higher, for 4 straight years, which had never been done in the Big Ten. I can't tell you the last time that's been brought up to me in a meeting or been written about, right? Like, we did things that had not been done. We've graduated every player. We will have been at, this year, we'll have been at 9 guys that will have graduated in 3 years. Cody Zeller will walk this spring after leaving after 2 years. If they don't want to bring that up, they're not bringing it up, right? And so at the end of the day, it really does come down to the winning. And anybody that says differently is not really living in this environment. And that's why I keep looking at it and saying to my family, hey, we didn't fail. You know, we didn't lose, okay? We had some tough losses this year. You know, those aren't the things that happen. But when they want to make a decision, you know, you're at the mercy of that decision. And I can see in the NBA why the average NBA coach, all right, is going to go in there and say, like, I see this happen all the time. They get the shorter deals that are happening now. And so, like, they want to win right now. If a rookie is not ready to play, all right, they're not going to play him if they have a choice. And so I think the crux of the development of a collegiate player being able to go in and play for an NBA team, all right, and not just be NBA draftable, which most people think is good enough, and really not just be NBA ready, which is a misnomer, but be ready to win. And there's such a big difference on being draftable, ready, and ready to win. And the winning habits have got to come in your details. They've got to come with your technique inside of those details. It's got to come from your work ethic. It's got to come from your desire to make your teammates better. It's got to come from the extra work that you do, not only in the court, but the film room. And in college, it's really, really easy because the way the rules are, all right, to have limited time to do that with guys. So if you don't have an environment in college that doesn't have the guys structured where they feel responsible and accountable to want to come in there and work on their own, to get with not only managers that are rebounding a ball, but in our case, we had a lot of graduate managers that wanted to be coaches that could help make them better. Those are the things that really, really matter. Where in the NBA, to me, you never have to worry about who's working out with your team. You don't have to, well, you do as a coach, you might have too many workout guys for them in a place, but you can hire a staff that you can really let work on basketball. And I think that's what Jeff says makes so much sense. Part of running an NBA-style system or having guys get ready for the NBA is to try to teach them as much as you can about what it means to have a professional mindset in your work ethic and in your desire, and so that when a coach gets them at the level of Jeff and at the level of the NBA, they don't have to sit there and teach them how to be in the gym, or they don't have to sit there and teach them how to want to get better, or they don't have to sit there and teach them how to watch film or how to take care of their bodies. They can make them better at it, but they already have an understanding of it if you've done it right. And that's what in college, you're limited, but you better make sure you're maxing out everything you possibly can if you want to have people get better. Because there's not in recruiting, I would say, okay, this is my opinion, it'd be hard to look at it for anything less than 80% of the players that you're going to recruit that don't absolutely believe in their mind or their family's mind that they're going to be NBA players. And it's not much of a less percentage under 80 for those people that think they're going to get there at an early stage, not just after 4 years.
Yeah. And Adrian, I want to add something to that too. It's something I don't know if I'm right on this, but I'm starting to notice this more and more. NBA players, pre-game or, you know, pre-practice, they love the workout. Watching guys pre-game, it's evolving from what it used to be like 10, you know, years ago, in that they would come out and they would get warm and shoot some shots and, you know, get their mind ready. But they didn't want to overdo it. It was just purely to get, you know, themselves warm and ready to play. Now I see this evolution of, you know, because of skilled coaches and skill development being obviously always a priority, they're out there longer and they seem to love the workout, but I'm not so sure they love to compete against the opponent as much as I think they should. And so if I was a college player, where besides, you know, having the requisite skills, I would ask myself each and every day, am I an ass-kicking type of competitor, coach, or am I sort of soft? You got to tell me, because the thing that can separate you now in the NBA is the love of competition, not the love of the lifestyle, but the love of competition and putting yourself out there where you're not running for most liked NBA player, most respected NBA player because of how hard you're willing to compete. And I think that's an evolution slowly but surely that's changing in the NBA.
This is the Vertical Podcast with Woj.
Tom, Jeff, I know both of you are pretty big baseball fans and you like watching Major League Baseball spring, summer, and of course in the fall, just like I do. Well, if you're anything like us, then you need T-Mobile because they're giving away a free year of MLB.TV Premium. That's a $112.99 value, absolutely free, and only for T-Mobile customers. And here's the best part. With T-Mobile One, unlimited data means unlimited baseball. That means you can keep up with your favorite team from almost anywhere. Every pitch, every big moment, every walk-off home run, all without worrying about blowing up your phone bill. Stream, post, and share all things MLB. Sound good? Well, here's how you get it. First, get T-Mobile, obviously. Second, download the T-Mobile Tuesday app from the App Store. Third, and this is important, on April 4th, get your free year of MLB.TV Premium in the T-Mobile Tuesdays app. That's it. Now just relax and enjoy any out-of-market games, plus unlimited stats, highlights, and more from almost anywhere. Remember, on April 4th, get your free year of MLB.TV Premium through the T-Mobile Tuesdays app or go to T-Mobile.com/MLB. Top 3% of data users greater than 30 gigabytes per month may notice reduced speeds. Activate HD feature, otherwise video typically streams at 480p. Web-enabled mobile device and qualifying service required. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission. Blackouts and other restrictions apply. See terms of use for details. Jeff, you talk about the idea of competing, and, you know, Tom sees this in college where when guys think about what the NBA is going to be like versus what the reality is for almost all, unless you're a lottery pick, and even if you're a lottery pick, there's a pretty good chance you're going to spend time in the D-League, that you're going to do the 5 a.m. wake-up call, fly on Southwest, connect through Chicago to get to Sioux Falls or the Iowa Energy, that, like, go through the last couple drafts. There's very few guys who aren't spending some time in the D-League. And guys get down there and they realize the difference, the talent gap's not that great between me and that guy and that guy. And all of a sudden, I think guys' view of what all this is has changed because of getting sent down, not playing, you know, very few rookies are in rotations, especially on good teams, that I think there's an expectation of, I don't know, they think that their life's going to be Russell Westbrook, Harden's life, when in fact, and I think Tom and I were talking about this before, like, you know, whatever the percentage is, maybe 90% of the players in the NBA are role players, if we're being honest about it, right?
Yeah, I mean, and on some teams, there's no stars, but I think the thing that most college players think is when I make it to the NBA, I'm really going to enjoy basketball because I don't have to go to school and I'll have money. And I think a lot of guys realize once they get there that a lot of the joy of the game of basketball is sucked out of their experience because of the business of basketball. And when you're a young player who's only known success, this is why it's hard to evaluate as an NBA evaluator. When you've only known success, it's hard to evaluate how someone will react to failure. Will they have the requisite persistence and grit necessary to navigate through difficult times and challenges? And or are they going to blame everyone else for not playing? Because, as you mentioned, Adrian, playing time is hard to get, particularly when you're young and coming in, unless you're just coming into a horrible team. And when you come into a horrible team, it's a whole nother set of losing and lack of professionalism that usually lead you into losing as much as those teams are. So it's not as joyful of an experience as college is. There's certainly some advantages, but certainly I think very few players are really prepared that this is going to be a business, and businesses have their downsides. And part of it is they're never going to feel the joy that they felt in college.
One thing that happens a lot, and it's been happening, I'll never forget the first guy that did it with my team at Marquette was Jason Richardson after, I think it was his rookie year in Golden State. And I hadn't coached Jason, but I had recruited him to Michigan State, and then I left for Marquette. And the Warriors were playing the Bucks, and we're playing. And it was after maybe a couple, I think it was his rookie year. He came in and he said to the team, "See, you will never understand how much you will miss the bus rides, hanging out in the locker room, all right, sitting around eating. You'll never understand how much you'll miss that till you don't have it, because it's all different now." And that was Jason Richardson's rookie year, my probably fourth year at Marquette. Every time somebody comes back and talks to the team, okay, over all these years, whether it be Dwayne Wade, whether it would be Cody Zeller, whether it be Victor Oladipo, you know, all these different guys, when they would come back and talk to one of the teams, they might say it differently. They might give a different example, but it all comes back under the same umbrella. It's completely different. And then the other part of it that happens, because again, in recruiting, to me, you're not recruiting from teams, you're trying to recruit from programs. And it doesn't always work out that way, but the more you can recruit from a program, the better it's going to be. Well, you're also not just recruiting the player, you're recruiting the family. And you have to really, really evaluate that family and their desires. And again, you can't look at it and say, well, they'll be real patient with the process. That's not possible, okay? They're going to want the process to move as fast, for the most part, as anybody else would, because they see the business of basketball before they understand the process and how you get to the business of basketball. And to me, you have to work through that, because you're going to go through a lot of different scenarios and situations to try to help somebody get to that point. And the bottom line is, if you're not careful, all right, and you let things infiltrate your head and you let things infiltrate your mind, you start thinking, like Jeff said, about how much they're going to enjoy basketball, how much they're going to enjoy that life. They lose details on the fact that the NBA, outside of true potential, all right, in the sense of size or length, or from drafting a foreign-born player, you have got to have some performance behind you, because you may get drafted on potential, but it's going to be a rare case where the coach is going to play you on that potential. And then if the programs want to win, all right, that's where the D-League comes in. That's where the workouts that Jeff's talking about come in. You know, the one thing that I saw one time that really stood out to me, and I don't hardly ever see this anymore, I went to a practice one time in Milwaukee when George Karl was there and Michael Curry was still playing. And Michael Curry was organizing one-on-one after practice with the younger players. And that was back when George had Ron Adams and Mike Tebow and Terry Stotts, and Chad Forcier was behind the bench. Just a great staff, right? But here was a player that was organizing those one-on-one games. I'm not sure how much that happens, but you're certainly not going to see very much high-level one-on-one, even at the collegiate level, unless you organize it, all right, unless you really kind of demand it. That's not easy. And most guys are not going to put themselves in a work situation that is anything more than what they see as beneficial, which is shooting the ball, maybe some ball handling. And Jeff's exactly right. It's very, very hard to get somebody to understand that toughness is a talent. And really, if you're going to be tough, you have got to compete. And it takes a lot. In the NBA, Jeff, would you say that is 70% of making your open shots a good number or an above-average number for an NBA player?
Well, I think, Tom, what you have to do is you have to understand, first of all, what your shot is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, everybody wants to take the same shot. You know, everybody says the same things analytically. I want to make a three, a layup, and free throws, right? But
sure.
If you're not a good three-point shooter, like, can you make enough, you know, mid-range shots to stay on the floor? And if a lot of this is, yeah, you can improve, but can you find your way to the floor? You know, similar to what you were saying, like, Jimmy Butler wasn't a polished offensive player. But because he defended, he found his way onto the floor after his rookie year and then
sure.
allowed his work ethic to impact. You know, now he still got minutes because of his defense. Now he improved his offense, and now all of a sudden, you know, he's a max-level all-star type player. So, you know, you've got to have something to get you onto the floor. A lot of guys, you know, just don't have that. You mentioned one-on-one. It's very interesting to me, guys, is that when I came into the NBA back in 89, every day after practice, somebody played one-on-one. Like, you didn't organize it as a coach. They paired up, and they went at it. And I wouldn't say it was 100% effort, but I would say it was like 90%. The ability to, and you mentioned this earlier, Tom, to navigate in tight spaces with limited dribbles, being able to create separation and then, you know, make it, being able to guard your own position. This happened every day. Slowly but surely, by the time I ended coaching, the only time one-on-one was ever played was when it was forced by coaches. And I think it's an absolutely huge loss for the players that they don't play more one-on-one from a competitive standpoint, from an ability to learn how to guard your own position, to be able to create separation, and finding out what type of shot you can actually make. I'm not sure why the workout coaches don't believe in one-on-one, but certainly as the league has evolved, you rarely, if ever, see unforced one-on-one, where players are voluntarily finding someone else to compete against.
Sure. I think an answer to that a little bit, like with the workout guys, they're like some of the younger coaches you bring into their staff. Now, whether they understand how the value of one-on-one and a dribble limit, a two-dribble limit, a three-dribble limit, whatever it is, which is so important in those aspects, so it just doesn't become a pickup game one-on-one, they don't want to upset the player, right? The level of demand that you've got to put on your best players, all right, is so high if they don't understand how to put it on themselves. And it's a rare guy. An example of it just brought up a memory for me. I went to see the Heat practice during one of the championship years. I was in Chicago for the Big Ten meetings, and I went over to Illinois, Chicago, to watch them practice. And so I saw the practice. It's you know, it's Chris. It's obviously Dwayne. It's LeBron. It's the whole group. The practice ends, and it's an intense practice. Eric ran a great practice. Well, the practice ends. Some guys are getting shots. They all had to wait probably another 15, 20 minutes because Dwayne and LeBron were playing a competitive, serious one-on-one game. Not a smile for the cameras. Obviously, with Pat Riley and Eric Spoelstra, there's no cameras in there. It was not a let me throw up half-court shots, let me work on my hook shot. It was a competitive one-on-one game. Like, I looked at that and I said, that's part of the reason. That's part of the DNA, but most importantly, that's part of the edge that those two guys play with. And I haven't seen that very much. And I think one of the problems, especially in college, there's limits to the amount of time that you can have. We would do an organized one-on-one-on-one-on-one drill that I saw Lawrence Frank do one time when he was in New Jersey. And it was hard. I mean, it would be 3 minutes. If you scored, you stayed. If you got a foul, you went right into the post. The guy had to defend you in the post, and he used it like as a break, you know, for the other guys to watch these guys play. You don't see that very much, and to me, it gets harder and harder to make guys better when you're afraid to push them beyond where they want to be. And all that does is escalate as they get to your level, to the NBA level, because the money's greater. There's more of an investment in the workout guy, and the workout guy doesn't want to lose that investment. And he doesn't want to lose that ability to have that. And you see it even in the high school edge. I mean, more and more kids change high school or change high schools, but more importantly, they change AAU programs because too many coaches are afraid to push somebody beyond what that person feels are their limits. If you don't push somebody beyond what their limits are, they never find out what their limits are. And too many people are getting a false sense of security and hope and believing that they're at a place that they're really not. And then all of a sudden they get to college, okay, and they've got a rude awakening. And if they're good enough to get an opportunity in the NBA, they've got an incredibly rude awakening. And that's where Adrian says the guys that I'm sure it's got to be a real challenge for people that had these dreams and beliefs that they're going to be staying at the Ritz-Carlton every night or the Four Seasons, and all of a sudden they're staying at a Courtyard Marriott with nothing wrong with Courtyard Marriott, getting on a bus and driving 4 hours to another D-League game. And they don't think that's possible.
This is the Vertical Podcast with Woj.
We'll get back to our conversation with Jeff and Tom in a moment. But first, I have to tell my listeners about Blue Apron and how they can get 3 free meals just by using my name, Woj. Guys, not all ingredients are created equal. Fresh, high-quality ingredients make a real difference. So it's important to know where your food comes from. And we all know there's nothing better than a great home-cooked meal, and no one makes it easier for you to do that than Blue Apron. Their mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone, and Blue Apron knows that when you cook with incredible ingredients, you make incredible meals. So they set the highest quality standards for their suppliers and only bring you the best ingredients and all of it right to your door. Plus, each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and pre-portioned ingredients, and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Now listen closely, because this is the part about the 3 free meals I was telling you about. Check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free, along with free shipping, by going to blueapron.com/woj. Once again, that's blueapron.com/woj, W-O-J. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. And now back to our guests, Tom Crean and Jeff Van Gundy. Whenever I go to the D-League showcase where they have all the D-League teams together in one place and they're all playing, you know, USA Basketball does things with their, you know, the great 16 and under, 17 and under, 18 and under team, which are all the top players, right? They're the top guys in each age group. And they all believe they're going to be lottery picks, and some of them will be. And, you know, sometimes they take them out to the Team USA national team practice in Vegas so they can watch LeBron and, you know, Dwayne Wade and who's ever on the Olympic team at that time. And I always say, like, I'll be at that showcase and I'll say, I wish they took those kids to that event and gave them bios of each of the players on the court, because they would see themselves out there. They'd see, yeah, that guy there playing for Bakersfield was the number 4 player in his class in high school and played USA Basketball and was 2-time all-conference in the ACC or Big Ten. And here he is. Like, that's you. And I always thought, like, that's where more guys are going to end up there than in getting big contract extensions, getting in the All-Star game. But I do think that, I think there's a false sense of reality that's delivered to these guys that I think, like you said, Tom, like, you've got to kind of undo that at the college level. Absolutely. And get some realism.